I want to take a moment and just explain the title. We originally intended to be speaking to a bunch of people that were thinking intensively about paleosols. My colleague at Southern Methodist University, Dr. Tabor, is a geochemist. And he called me and said, well, I'm in downtown Dallas. I need a place to dig some soil pits to show my graduate students what a real soil looks like. And I said, well, come on down. And we're about 2.5 hours from Dallas-Fort Worth, so his students were able to come down. Now, the objective of him coming out to Stephenville was to use modern soil analogs to convey concepts of paleoclimate studies in his graduate course. And so when we saw the data, we said, well, gee, this is interesting. And so it caused us to and forced us to then submit this paper and think about future studies. To give you a sense of location, Texas, and then in the little Texas map in the upper right is the little red polygon, which is Arath County. And then in the Arath County in the bottom left is, Stephenville polygon. And outside of Stephenville is a 470-hectare ranch that is owned by Tarleton State University. And that's where these sites were located at. And this is where I took them to look at some, to see soil where it lives. And so to get down on the ground, now what I would love to do is have Star Trek and take a transporter and go there, because that's what we love, is to see it where it lives. And there's two sites. And the thing I want to impress upon you in this picture is that they're the same landform and they're about 150 meters apart. And you can see the vegetation. You might want to note that we're, you know, what it looks like. Other site characteristics, soil moisture regime is ustic. We get bimodal precipitation, and it's a little bit greater in the spring, 740 millimeter average rainfall annually. It's a thermic soil temperature regime. The entire area is, in both these sites, fall within a polygon that's mapped as a eutic paleoustalf. Now, These pits have been open for a little while. They probably, they might have been open since one of my colleagues was there. And we went to gussy them up. And of course, obviously when the students were looking at this, they scraped the face and sampled back into the profile. But I just wanted to give you a sense of the two sites. They do look quite different. They sampled in these soils, where the graduate students sampled to do their work was. And this is a diagram of clay distribution with depth and keyed on the middle of the horizon. They sampled in the carbonate rich horizons for these two profiles. Well, here's Dr. Tabor, and I want to point out kind of as fun is that he's wearing a shirt that says "Stand back, I'm about to do science," and this is. It's kind of hard to see, but this is his isotope line. And this causes me to say that I wish it was the show that, you know, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and I had, you know, phone an expert and phone a friend, because I'm afraid you're going to ask me questions about some things about isotope that he's been thinking 15 years over, and I won't have the, I'll stammer and stutter a little bit. So that's my excuse. Okay, so with this complicated diagram, a lot of data on here, so I want to, first of all, I want to make your eyes go to the left on the y-axis, that's organic matter, and that's our delta 13 carbon per mil. And then on the x-axis, we have calcite delta 13 on that axis. The line that you see bisecting at the top, going from the southwest to the northeast, is a one-to-one line. For reference. Now the yellow is site 3 and the black is site 1. And the values are here for the calcite for site 1 and the calcite for site 3 and the organic for site 1 and site 3. So just to summarize this diagram is that, you know, for organic matter delta 13, not a great big difference. about what goes from 3 to 9. Quite a big difference for calcite. The big difference calcite. In organic matter, however, there is not a great big difference. So I'm gonna kind of give you a glimpse, much the way they do in the movies, of the end, of the most exciting part of the talk, and where we were going with this, is if we were to look at this diagram based on organic matter, there's a line drawn at about 22. And a dry line drawn about 15 for organic matter, and anything above the 15 that would be C4 plants is the way they would be interpreting this sort of data, and anything below 22 would be C3 plants. So this is how they're interpreting the data, and remember now both sites are occupied by C3 plants now, and this is something that they don't have. When they're looking at paleosols, they don't have that luxury of knowing what the vegetation is when they are there, or when the soil was formed. We do. Why are the calcite differences there? Why is there such a great difference? Well, immediately we think, well, gee, it must be productivity is the key. So that's kind of jumping to the end. And let me just step through this because, quite frankly. Again, a lot of us don't think about this sort of thing. So this is how the fractionation equation looks. And I feel like if I was sitting in your seat, I would think, oh my Lord, I'm in a soil physics talk with equation after equation. This is the only equation I'm going to show. So I'm not going to show one after the other. And what we're really doing here is we're looking at the atmospheric concentration of CO2 at 1850 levels. And looking at the calcite, and then looking at the calcite formed only in equilibrium with atmospheric C2, and then formed only in equilibrium with oxidation of organic matter, and trying to get at what they try to do is they try to get at what was the conditions on the ground based on the soil and the carbonates that are left there. Well, when Neil showed me this diagram, I said, well, gee, that looks like a logarithmic decay curve. And I'm missing a legend here. The legend on the left is calcite minus organic matter. So that's how that curve breaks out. And notice it once again that at the bottom we have soil CO2, and notice the very great difference in soil CO2 part per million by volume. Very large difference between the sites. The way that these people look at these sites is trying to figure out C3, C4 biomass looking at the paleosol calcite. In the previous studies, apparently quite famous and used quite a bit, this Fox and Koch, looking at where they make some assumptions. They make the assumptions such as that C3 delta 13 carbon organic matter is at negative 25.5 part per mil. C4 is negative 11.5. Then the atmospheric CO2, 280 part per million by volume. And they assume that the soil CO2 is 2800 part per mil volume. Now, so again, we have the luxury of knowing what vegetation is there, so we already know what the story is. But this is very instructive for those students, and this is the kind of thing that they would do is they would then plot del 18 oxygen, and the y-axis here has disappeared, but it's the calcite, or del 13 carbon. And they're able to then use that equation to be able to think about what C3, C4. Now, if without knowing what the vegetation was and knowing what we know, they would say that site 3 was what was influenced. The calcite was influenced by 50% to 70% C4 plants, and we know that that's not the case. So that's very interesting, and I think that the one thing that we can say immediately is that. they have to be careful, or we have to be careful, we're thinking about paleosols, is you don't just do a vertical transect at some site in Argentina or Africa or wherever that might be. You also have to sample laterally across the landscape and think about heterogeneity on the landscape, because we're seeing it in present day, in the present day analogs. So this is, once again, their assumptions. And by way of these assumptions, I want to kind of integrate and conclude with this. And that is that when we look at their assumptions, I'd say, well, yeah, but ours was negative 22 to negative 26. It wasn't 25.5. So their assumptions obviously leave some room for error based on the reality on the ground. And then the big one down here at the bottom is soil CO2, they fix it at 2,800 parts per million volume by volume. And we had vast differences from 700 to 3,200. And of course, as soil scientists in modern day systems, we obviously would recognize that as bioproductivity and changes and differences in the morphology of the soil. So we started out with an objective of using modern soil analogs to convey concepts of paleoclimate studies in a graduate course. And indeed, the graduate students were very excited to get out there, and they sampled these soils and they got really turned on. They went back and they made some measurements. And they really spotlighted some deficiencies in the assumptions that are made in their discipline, the fledgling experts in their discipline. And it really also points out the changes in soil productivity across the landscape can confound these simple assumptions in these models that they use. And of course, we said, you know, the changes in the soil productivity then swamp this C3, C4 estimates. And that's all I have for you. I'm gonna put the light back on. So.
Any questions, Dr. McGinn?
Yes,
Curtis.
Yeah. So that's a really good way you pointed out the assumptions that are commonly made. There's one other huge assumption in this study, and that is the age of the carbonate versus the age of the organic matter in the modern vegetation. So do you have any sense how old the carbonate crystals are?
No, and one of the questions that I asked, now that I've moved to the land of limestone, was, well, I said, gee, Neil, could some of this, you know, carbonate, could this have come from the limestone? You notice that it was, you ask a great question, because notice there was no site two. That was actually up on the limestone. And so I said, well, gee, Neil, what's the likelihood that some of that is Aeolian additions and is, you know, moved into the profile? And what is the likelihood that some of it's overland flow and has moved in the profile? And he said, no, wait. That's part of the assumption, is we assume that doesn't happen, that all the calcite is there from within the profile. And so, yeah, landform, the same terrace, we assume that we then constrain that way. That's the thinking. But as far as additions, I'm really uncomfortable with it. But that is indeed what they do. Is they assume everything is from within the profile.
I think maybe just to follow on to Curtis's question, but is it possible that some of that apparent C4 signature of the carbonate was because the calcite is older and there were C4 plants on the site at one time, and now there's C3 plants, but they're carbonates that were produced by C4 plants that you're measuring when you're doing your isotope signature?
We're back in the box that they're working with. When you assume that, and of course the historical records of vegetation in the area are incomplete, but there's nothing in there to give us any indication that it was dominated by C4 plants for a significant period of time.
Other than
our carbonates. Again, that gets back to my uncomfortableness with their assumptions and with the circumstance that Now, them saying that, well, gee, the way we do this is that everything, that there is no influence from the limestone. I believe there is, and I think that's specifically, that's why we've written a proposal, and we're talking about trying to look at what are the additions to a site like that, because I believe that there are.
One last question, Dr. McCullough.
Yeah, I was just going to comment that you cannot discount the Aeolian additions, because my dad lives in Granbury, and about twice a year he calls me up and says, come get your front yard off the front of the car.
Yeah.
It continues to go on and probably has for eons.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.